Sashi.
Put down name, student ID. Can I just plug this thing in while you do that? There is no. That's where it is. Okay, good. Thanks. Right, so let's get started here. So welcome. My name is Prashant Shenoy. I will be the instructor for 377. And what we are going to do today is just a quick introduction to what this course is about. So I will run through the syllabus for the class. I will also give you a quick introduction to what operating systems are about. Okay. There's a sign up sheet going around. Make sure you put your name and email address and student ID on there so I can just go back and look at what is Inspire and who came to the class. Okay. If you have not registered for this class, come see me at the end of the lecture. Okay. Some of you had written to me, you needed an override for a variety of reasons, and I have some override forms here. The course is not full, so you should be able to get in so long as you have the background and have satisfied the prerequisites. Okay, so come talk to me at the end of the class. Okay, so all right. So as I mentioned, the agenda for today is to just to go through the syllabus, course organization, talk about policies, and then do a quick introduction. So let me start with the course. So everything I will talk about in the class will be on the course webpage. Okay, so you can just go to my home page and there will be a link. There will be a link to the course webpage. That's what the URL is. I'll show you the webpage in just a second. You can always contact me by email. You don't have to write most of this down. The lecture notes will always be posted to the course page just before class. So these notes are already up there. You can just download a PDF. Okay. So that's my contact information. The TA is Sashi Singh. He is here. Okay, so you know who he is. I'll talk about office hours and so on. So Sashi is going to lead the discussion section for the course, which is on Wednesdays. Okay. and I'll talk about what the discussion section entails in a moment. Sorry? Yes, sure. You don't have to write any of this down. It's all on the web page. I'll show that to you in a moment. So, yeah, okay. So, if you can get to my page, you should be able to get to the course web page. But that's all right. So, prerequisites 187, data structures architecture. There is a book for the course. Okay, so it's operating systems concepts. You can either use the 7th or the 8th edition. Okay, they are more or less similar. For the purposes of this course, the new material in the 8th edition doesn't add that much. Okay, so I'll let you have the flexibility of choosing the 7th edition. If you can get an inexpensive copy, go ahead. There's no problem. Okay, if you're going to pay for the full price, you may as well get the new edition. But if you can get something cheaper, that is fine. Okay, it should be in the textbook annex. I believe they said they could only stock the 8th edition because they could no longer find the 7th. Okay, but if they found copies, they are going to stock it. I don't quite know what has happened, so you can check. Okay. Course requirements, we'll have 4 to 6. Okay, that's a typo. There's 4 to 6 homeworks. Okay, that will be 20% of the grade. There will be, this might include some in-class assignment. Okay, so that's a motivation for you to keep coming to class. Okay, because there may be some assignments we may hand out. Either here or in the discussion section. Okay, 4 programming assignments, 40% of the grade. Okay, then I think there are too many typos. There should be 2 exams, not 3. Important detail. 2 exams, a midterm and a final, 20% each. Okay, there'll be late policies I'll talk about and so on. Okay, as you probably know about the course involves a big programming component, okay, and we will use the EdLab for this purpose, specifically the Linux machines in the EdLab. I will talk about the programming projects in just a moment. Okay, so you should have an EdLab account. If you are registered for the course, an account is automatically created. Perhaps you had an account in the past. It will probably be the same account name and so on. Okay, so you need to make sure you have one, because we'll use that for the project. I'll talk about that. There's a discussion section which will be on Wednesdays. Shashi is going to lead the discussion section, and the purpose of having that section is to supplement what we do here. Okay, so perhaps there may be questions you have about lecture material. Feel free always to come and talk to me. But we will also supplement the lectures with discussions where you can go ask questions. Okay, the 2 important reasons to go to the discussion sections are the homeworks and the projects will be discussed in the discussion section primarily. Okay, whenever we hand out a homework, the homework will be reviewed, maybe some material will be reviewed to give you the right background. And same is true of the programming assignment. Okay, you will get extra help by going to the discussion sections, ask questions and whatnot. Okay, yes, question.
Can you send an email to the class, are you going to send it to the EdLab account, or are you going to send it to the student account?
Okay, so question about email. So I believe there will be a list that is set up for the course, okay, a mailing list. As far as I know, the mailing list actually sends email to your official UMass address. I'm going to verify this and get back to you, okay? But that said, I'll talk about the projects in just a moment. The projects use what is called an auto grader system where you submit your solutions by email. There's a program that actually runs that and grades it for you, and that sends your results back. And that email actually goes back to your EdLab account. Okay, so it is important for you, no matter what you do, to make sure that you either forward your mail from your EdLab account or you check your email on your EdLab account. Okay, because even if the mailing list may send email to your official UMass student address, the auto grader is going to use your EdLab account. Yes, question there.
Does the EdLab accounts have SSH or something?
Yes, question. Yes. About access to the EdLab account. SSH is all enabled. Okay, you are welcome. I think the next question someone is going to ask is, can you use your laptop to do the assignment? Right. So you are more than welcome to use any machine you want to do your assignment. But it is very important that you check that your assignment will compile on the compilers on the EdLab account. okay? Because that is what the autograder is going to use. You can't tell the autograder it works on my Mac and it doesn't work. If it doesn't work on that Linux machine, it's going to send you a failed status back and you will not know why. Okay? So you feel free to use have the development environment here, but be sure before you submit or for debugging that you actually use your EdLab accounts, because sometimes the compilers are not the same, GCC versions are not the same, and what might compile on one machine may not compile there. And it's not possible for the EdLab, the autograder, to figure out what compiler you use to compile your program. Okay? This is the only reason why you should make sure that you have an EdLab account and whatever you submit actually works there. Okay? But you can use your laptop for any other purposes. Is that clear? Any other questions on that? Okay, so office hours. My office hours will be immediately after this class. Okay, so this is useful because you may have questions right after the class. You can come and talk to me immediately. Okay, so that helps you clarify, and you can always come for any other reason. So 2:30 to 3:30, but class ends at 2:15, so I'll be available at 2:15. Okay, Sashi is going to have his office hours on Mondays and Fridays from 1 to 2 in LGRT. This is the tower. It's the room next to the EdLab. That right? Okay. So he's going to be available on Mondays and Fridays. So there's a discussion section on Wednesdays, and he's available for help then. So you will have someone available every day of the week. Okay. So I'm available Tuesdays and Thursdays, and so she's available Monday to Friday for office hours and Wednesdays for discussion. Okay. So you should make use of this. If you have any questions at any point, you can see someone on that day, most likely. Okay, I already mentioned programming projects, so I'll talk about that in just a little. Okay, so there will be four programming assignments, as I mentioned on the syllabus. Okay, the first one is a very simple one, just to get you warmed up, and there will be three more substantial assignments. Okay, and we will use C++. For the programming assignment. I don't know how many of you are now familiar with C++, because you still do most of our earlier projects in Java. Okay? So it's important for you to learn C++ for this course. Okay? We will have a couple lectures here devoted to C++ if you're not familiar with it. The TA is going to have some additional discussion section. And I'll provide some references so that you can bring yourself up to speed if you haven't programmed in C++. So that is something you should be aware of. Yes, question there.
We're using C++, so we require to use like header files and everything. So
okay, just throw it all into. Okay, so there's a question about, do you need to have header files or do you need to do everything in one file and so on, right? So the way the auto grader works, right? So because we are using this automatic grading program, you have to submit your entire assignment in one file. Okay, even though it may be good programming practice to have header files where you store. Rather declare constants and data structures and so on. You can't submit a zip file or a tar file and have the thing work. So you have to, the projects are designed so that your entire assignment actually fits in one file. You just email it to the autograder, it compiles it and it sends you back some results. Okay, that is the way it is going to work. So everything is just one CPP file per assignment, to answer your question. Okay? So, there's a late policy, which I'll talk about in just a moment. Okay, so the way the autograder works, so it's a program. And what you do is, once we give you an assignment, you can start working on the assignment. And you can submit your assignment once a day to this program. And you submit by email. And once we give out the first assignment, I'll have details on where to email your assignment. Okay? So once you email it, the autograder will then compile it. And it will run the program with some test cases. And then it mails you back a report saying what happened. So it may say something like your thing didn't compile. Okay, or maybe it compiled, but when it ran it, it gave a segmentation fault and your program crashed. Or it may say that your test case didn't work. So your program compiles fine, but it doesn't do what it is supposed to do. Or if everything was great, then it may say your program works. Okay, against all of the test cases. So you will get these results back. You can submit once a day, okay, until the deadline, from the time the assignment is handed out. Okay. You're also allowed three extra submissions, okay, just in case the deadline is near, because you cannot submit more than once a day. In the normal case, we'll allow you three bonus submissions. Okay, and so in the last few days, you can submit more than once, but only up to three more times than the once a day rule. Okay, so you can do that and it will tell you what happened every time you submit. Okay, you can't submit. If you submit more than that, it won't send you back a result. Okay, that's the way it works. And we are going to use it for perhaps either two or three of our assignments. Okay, the fourth assignment is more complex, so we cannot automate it to a level that we would like it to, so that may just be the normal, you just turn in your assignment and the TA is going to grade it for you. Okay, the auto grader is very convenient because you get instant feedback, okay, but it also does extra things, like it's going to check your program against the repository of programs it has for similarities and cheating and whatnot. So make sure any code you turn in is your own, because if it is not, you may well get caught because it's going to flag it. Okay, so be careful. Okay, and I'll have more to say about the auto grader when we hand out the first assignment, but this should give you a flavor of how it works. Okay, now although your program is being graded by a machine, not a person, so she is still going to look at your assignment for style. Okay, there will be some points for style and some points for correctness. So making sure your program is well documented, well written, readable, all that still matters. Okay, for the auto grader, it doesn't matter because it just compiles it and runs it. But we will still have some points for all of these other things. Okay, as I mentioned, two exams, 20% each. Okay, there's a midterm, which will cover the first half of the course. Okay, there's a final exam that is cumulative, meaning that it covers the whole course, but emphasis is given to the second half of the course in the final. But anything that was covered before is also fair game for the final. Okay, all exams are closed book, closed notes, okay, in class exams. Any questions on this so far? Is this clear? 20. 20 and 20. There are two exams. So each is 20%, four assignments. Okay. Assignments are, I think the first one will have a little less than 10, but the others maybe it will be 8, 11, 11 or something like that, but around 10% per assignment. Think of it that way. Okay, so I already mentioned all of this except for the late policy. So you also get 3 late days across all projects. Okay, you are free to use it any way you want. Okay, so, but beyond those 3 days, you will not get any more grace period for late submissions. Okay, is that clear? Talked about the EdLab accounts already, so make sure you have it. And if you don't intend to check mail there, make sure you forward it to an account you check mail. Otherwise, mail will pile up there and you will not know what is going on with the auto grader. Okay, so there's a plagiarism policy. Okay, this is a little bit sounds harsh, but I have to go through this just to make sure we are all on the same page. So, so be sure that any work you do is your own. Okay, don't borrow code from anyone, because there's an automated program testing against a fairly large repository. Okay, anyone has ever turned into the auto grader is recorded. So if you actually take code from anyone, it'll compare your program with all of that. Okay, so it does all of this automated check. So it's in your interest to be honest and yes. Well, it is
profit,
it's not used. It's not really being sold. Well, it's not even actually based here. It is a repository that's on the internet somewhere. So it's not just code that was submitted here. So don't even give your code to anyone for future years, because we reuse programs, right? So if you actually do that, then we cannot go and reuse these assignments in a future year. Okay, don't hire someone to write your code for you. This has happened in the past already. It sounds outrageous. And make sure your code is, all of this is your own. Okay, there's a policy that we have actually put up on as part of the syllabus on the page. Okay, and it's our general policy in this course to make sure you read it and sign it so that you understand what the policy is for this course. Okay. All right, so that's basically the syllabus. So let me show you one more thing, which is the course webpage. There are a couple of nice additional things. So This is actually not visible. Just a second. Okay, so that's what the course web page looks like. Okay, and there will be links here to a variety of things. So here is the syllabus. Okay, this is what I just talked about. Everything is here. Okay, there are lots of other policies. The one thing I didn't mention, which you can look at offline, is these will be group projects, just to make things simple for you. Okay, so you can form groups of two or three, not greater than three, for any project. Okay, so it's in your interest to find a good partner or two and form a group fairly early on. Okay, as soon as we hand out the first assignment, you will have to declare who your group is going to be. Okay, and there are policies on making sure everyone in the group contributes reasonably well. You have the rights to fire someone from your group if they are not contributing. Okay? Just as in the real world, if somebody is not working on a group project, they just get ejected from the group. So you have all of these rights and responsibilities. They are all spelled out here, okay, which I will not go into. Yes, question.
So the group work is for the program and project?
Group work is for the program.
But everybody's making their own code.
The group will submit one assignment.
So three people can submit one file?
Yes. These people will work for all of the programming project. Yes. Two, three, or one. Doesn't mean you have to have a group, but it's advisable to have one. Okay, but once you have a group, that group will turn in one assignment. Okay? Okay. So there are all these things about extension and so on. So you can look at that. More importantly, there are two other things. So everything I talk, show you on the slide is always posted to what is called the course schedule link. If you go there, you will see that the slides for today are there. Of course, you didn't know this ahead of time, but now that you do, next time you can actually print the slides, come to class and just take notes on the slides. Okay? So that makes it easier. The other two things which are offered on an experimental basis, so don't depend on them, is that I will also offer all of the course as an audio podcast. So you can actually look at the slide and got the audio. Okay, and we are also recording the class, so we are going to make the video also available. And so there are two cameras there. So it's, but that these are all experimental features. If there is a technical glitch, don't depend on it. Okay, so this is not a reason to stop coming to class because everything is online. Okay, but it is in useful for you to go back, review material. Okay, and then Sashi is also taking notes, so he's going to make notes of whatever he has written as a PDF. Okay, so you will have all of this extra material to make it easy for you. Okay, and I will have audio feeds and video feeds going shortly. Okay, is that clear? So those are additional things you can use for making good use of the material. Okay. So are there any questions on the syllabus? So I am actually required to hand out paper copies of the syllabus. Okay, but I decided not to waste any trees. But if anyone wants a paper copy, okay, you are welcome to ask and I'll print something out. But it's all there on the web page. Okay, is that fine? I presume that people are comfortable going online and reading stuff, right? Okay. So any questions before I move on? Yes, question. Oh, my office hours. Okay. So let's go back and... Okay. So my office hours are Tuesdays and Thursdays, 2:30 to 3:30. They are in 336. That's my office in this building. Okay, and as I mentioned, TA office hours, Mondays and Fridays, 1 to 2 in the LGRT, the tower, okay, next to the Ed Lab. That, any other questions here? Is this clear? Okay. So, let us... Okay. So now we will actually start a quick introduction to this course. Okay, so we'll now go into details of what is an operating system, why are we even interested in this course, and so on. Okay, so I'll start with a definition of what an OS is. It's basically a very simple definition, hasn't changed in the years. Okay, so let's basically look at your understanding of what an OS is. Oops. So, well, Bill Gates didn't invent the operating system. Okay, no different from Al Gore inventing the internet. But he was responsible for the DOS operating system in the early days as the founder and CEO of Microsoft and Windows, all of which made operating systems available on desktops and which sort of became widely used. Yeah, so when you think of an operating system, you basically think of the software that is running on your laptop or on your desktop. Okay, it typically would be Windows, Linux, Mac, or some flavor of Unix. Okay, so we'll now define what this piece of software does. Okay, so essentially, what this is doing, right? So your machine is based, has a hardware, okay, and then it has this layer called operating system, which is a piece of software that sits on this machine. Okay, now what is this software giving you? Okay, what it is doing, okay, it's hiding a lot of the ugly details of the hardware and presenting a nice, elegant interface to you, the user, so you can make good use of your machine to do a variety of things, okay, to read your email, to browse the web, to do your projects and whatnot. Okay, so in some sense, what it is basically it's an interface, okay, between the user and the underlying hardware that hides the underlying architectural details. You don't have to know when you're using a machine how much RAM is on your machine. Okay, maybe you know and maybe it's nice, but you don't really need to know where your program is loaded, where on the disks are your files. Okay. The OS takes care of all of these details. You create a file, you just need to remember its name, okay, to get to it at a later point. You don't have to worry about where on the disk is it stored, how is it stored. All of this is taken care of for you by the operating system. Okay, when you are using the network on your machine, okay, maybe it's a wireless network, maybe it's a wired network, you don't really have to know too much. Okay, so long as your machine is connected, okay, whatever that means, you can use the network on your machine to get to a website, to do some remote access and whatnot. So again, a lot of the details of how connections are established, all of this is handled by the operating system. Okay, so it is basically this interface that is hiding all of these details for you and making the machine much easier to use, okay, from your perspective. Okay, so in some sense, what it does is it implements a notion of a virtual machine. Okay, a virtual machine gives you an abstraction that is different from the underlying physical machine. Okay, and this machine is easier to program than the raw hardware. Okay, since this operating system provides this higher level abstraction, you can program in your favorite programming language. Okay, it may be Java, it may be C++, it may be Python, or any other programming language. You don't really have to worry about underlying machine details. Okay, you would have to if you are programming in assembly language. But typically, all of this is handled by the operating system and the runtime to convert your higher level program into underlying machine code. Okay, so basically, it gives you an illusion of a faster, more reliable machine. Okay. Now, this operating system also does one more thing. In addition to giving you this nice interface, it also acts as the resource management mechanism. Okay? So the hardware has a set of resources. The resources include the processor or the CPU, includes the memory, the disk, and the network. Okay? So the operating system not only gives you a higher level abstraction, it also manages these resources for you. Okay. So there may be multiple programs or processes running on your machine at the same time. The operating system decides which program gets to run, when does it get to run, how does it access the resources. Okay. So in other words, it's like the government, it divides resources. Okay. But it also taxes you in terms of an overhead because there is this software layer that is sitting between users and applications. There is the overhead of having to go through the operating system in order to access these resources. So if an application tries to access a file, it cannot directly access disk blocks. It has to access it through the file system, which resides in the operating system. And that adds some overhead. Okay? But this price is, the benefit of this overhead is outweighed by some of the extra abstractions that the operating system provides. Okay? So this, in a nutshell, is a definition of what an OS is going to do for you. Now, as you may have realized, the operating system has a set of components. Okay? These are the components that are used to manage various resources, the processor, the memory, the disk, and the network. Okay? And what this course is about is what is in this box, what is in this green box, what are the components, how do they work, how do these components manage the hardware, how do these components give you this nice abstraction so that you don't, or you or the application don't have to worry about it. Okay. So the course is essentially going to peek into this box, okay, and we are going to look at what is in there, how does it work. Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So now this is an active area of research, meaning that operating systems are continuing to evolve. They continue to get better, they continue to get new features. Okay, the operating systems that you got maybe even 5 years ago are very different from what today's operating systems can do. There are new applications that are coming out, and the operating systems have to evolve to meet the needs of these applications. So these are web-based applications, grid applications, and OSs continue to evolve. Okay? They become more internet-enabled, they become more grid-enabled, and we'll see what all of that means as we go along. At the same time, the hardware is also evolving. Okay? The operating systems have to evolve to meet the needs of the hardware. Okay? So today's hardware can do things that you couldn't do some years ago. If you have a tablet PC, for example, okay, you can write on the screen. The operating system has to figure out what is happening, what is being written, what application does it need to send this input to, and so on. Okay? So it has to evolve in order to meet this need. So there are new hardware coming out all the time. So today's Macs have more fancy mice than what you used to get some years ago. So there's this multi-touch mice that allow you to have gestures, and the mouse is going to recognize this for you. This requires additional capabilities in the operating systems, and so on. So they continue to evolve. So what, in other words, what you are going to learn is some basic concepts about what operating systems are about, but by no means is that the full picture, because in 5 years, things will be different. But some of the concepts do stay the same. Okay? And at the same time, there is this open source movement, and there are these operating systems like Linux and FreeBSD that have evolved to meet the needs of lots of users. Okay? And so the idea here is a set of volunteers, sort of group of volunteers, contribute to the design of a piece of software. In this case, it happens to be a kernel, but the open source movement is much broader than just OS development. So they actually go and implement new features, and they make it available to a large set of users. Okay? And this also results in faster development. It helps you not only to contribute to the design of the operating system, it also helps you to do other things, like you can use this OS for your research because the source code is available, you can modify it, you can add new features to it, okay? And you can experiment with it. Okay? Now, at some level, although this course is about the design of operating systems, okay, the principles that we will learn here actually apply to more than operating systems design. They apply to the design of any large-scale computing systems. And there are many of them. Okay? If you think about Amazon or Google, okay, these are large-scale software systems that are designed to address the needs of tens of thousands or millions of concurrent users. Okay? How do you go about designing such large software systems so that they are reliable to use, meaning that the system doesn't go down if some machine on the machine fails, or they're easy to use and they provide you all of the features you need. Okay? Some of the principles that we are going to learn here are going to equally well apply to the design of this large scale system. Okay? And because the operating system is itself a fairly large software component, some of these principles are going to be similar. Okay, so keep that in mind. Okay, we will actually use the operating system more as a case study into large-scale software design. Okay, and some of the projects, as you will see, go beyond design of operating systems or operating system concept. They will actually help you understand how some of these principles actually apply to the design of these larger systems. Okay. So that's something to keep in mind. Okay, now I'm going to provide a quick historical perspective into operating systems. Okay, how operating systems have evolved from the 1960s to today. Okay, it's around a 45-50 year history. We are going to do it in 9 slides, okay, as a sort of various phases of how computers evolved and how operating systems evolved to address the needs of these computers. Okay, so the early machines, this is going back to the early days of computing, okay, were single user machines. Okay? They were very large boxes. I mean, these mainframes could actually be larger than this room, the size of a room. Okay, yet it would do a fraction of what today's laptop computers can do in terms of processing power. Okay? Hardware was very expensive to build. Okay, if you looked at the cost of buying a machine, it would be in the millions of dollars. Okay? If you looked at the cost of hiring a programmer, would be probably tens of thousands of dollars. Okay? So in other words, in the early days, hardware was expensive, people were cheap. Okay? Yet the hardware would only support one user at a time. Because there was a console where you could do input and output. You could actually submit your program. The machine would run it and produce some output. Only one user could use the machine at a time. Okay? And while the user was actually punching in his program, nothing else was happening on the machine. The machine was just there sitting idle. Yeah, so it was an expensive machine that was just sitting idle while you submit a long program. And once you're done, it would run it and produce output. And the next user would have to come in and run his or her job. Okay? So there is no overlap between I/O and computation. Okay, I/O here is basically you type in your program on the console. Okay, that's input. And output is what comes back. And the computation is when you run the program. So there's no overlap. Okay, and user had to sit at the console to debug if the program didn't work. Okay, so it was a very laborious, very inefficient use of expensive hardware resources. Okay, so the next step in the evolution of computing was to somehow make more efficient use of the machine. Okay? And this led to the notion of what is called batch processing. Okay? Rather than have a user sit there and spend, let's say, 3 hours inputting their program, and then the program runs for 5 minutes and says, didn't work. Okay, then you basically wasted 3.5 hours of a very expensive resource. It was much better if you could actually come with the program ahead of time, okay, and just submit it as a batch. Okay? And lots of users could come, and then you could basically queue up all of these programs, and each of those could get loaded, not manually, but it could get loaded automatically, run very quickly, and a output is produced, and the next one runs, and so on. So you're not spending a lot of time doing input and output. And while one program is running, the next program in the queue could be loaded. Okay, so you can overlap I/O and computation and make better use of machine resources. Also, you are making more efficient use of the hardware as a whole, because you, multiple users can just come and submit their jobs and then go away. And 3 hours later, there is an output that is waiting for them. Okay. This is what is called batch programming. Okay. You execute multiple jobs in a batch. Each program is loaded, it runs, prints output, and repeat. Okay. So you could have a queue of jobs waiting to be run. Okay. Now, how do you come, how do you submit your jobs? You had this thing called punch cards, or you had tapes, so you would have to write your program ahead of time, put them on a punch card or a tape. Okay. Today's equivalent would be a USB stick. Okay, so you walk in with a stick and then you basically have your program there, and then it would just run it for you and produce an output. Okay. So now you need a better operating system to do this. Clearly, what was being done in the previous case and what is being done here from the perspective of the operating system is different. The OS has to evolve in order to address these needs over the previous one. Okay. Is this clear? Okay. So in this case now, I already talked a little bit about this. So here now you want to overlap I/O and computation. Okay? Now even in batch processing, you could basically just load one program, execute it, and output the result, and then load the next program. Okay, while you're loading that program, then nothing is happening on the machine. And it could be a long program, so it may take a while to load. Okay? You can make better use of resources if you could allow the next program to be loaded while the previous one is running. Okay? So this is a small step ahead in the notion of batch processing, where you're overlapping I/O and computation. Okay? So in this case, the data is filling the buffer, okay, and you're outputting, and the next program is being loaded at the same time. So as soon as the previous one finishes, the next one is already in memory ready to go. So you run. Okay? So if you have $1 million machine, you better want to make good use of it. So this allows you to make even better use of your expensive machine. So the machine is not idling while it's loading a program. Okay. So again, this requires further evolution of your operating system, okay, which allows you to make better use of resources. Okay. Now the next step in the evolution of operating systems is this feature called multi-programming. Okay. Everything we have talked about so far assumes that only one program can run on the machine at any given time. Okay. Now this, although may be good, it cannot make good use of hardware resources, because if the program has to wait block on I/O at any given time, it does not make good use of the resources. So for example, let's assume that you write a program and this program runs and it asks you for an input. Okay? Then you specify some input, and then it takes this input and does some computation, and then it produces an output. Okay? Now whenever, so when the program is loaded and it is going to ask you for an input, it is going to wait until you provide this input. Okay? So while it waits, again the machine is idling. So you are not making good use of the resources that are on your machine. So what multiprogramming allows you to do is it allows you to load multiple programs, as the name suggests, into memory at the same time. Okay? And it allows you to switch between programs. So let's say program one runs for some short period of time and it blocks for an input. Okay? While it is waiting for the input, the operating system can start running program two. Okay, and then maybe that program runs for a while and it blocks for some other input, okay, or it's producing some output. Okay, and while it does this, you run yet another program. So this makes you, allows you to make better use of the hardware on your machine. Okay, it allows multiple programs to run concurrently, okay, not in parallel. They're running one after another, but they're all loaded in memory. So as soon as one blocks for any reason, the next one gets to run. So you're overlapping the execution of multiple programs all at once. Okay? This is called multiprogramming. Now we take this as a given. Okay? On your laptop, you are probably running tens or hundreds of programs all at once. Okay? But this was a big step in the evolution of operating system, because in the early days, you could only run one program at a time. So if you are using, let's say, your browser for whatever reason, you cannot run your mail client if you are in a uniprogramming environment. You have to stop that program and then you run, load the next one and run. Okay, but in today's environment, you assume all of this. But in those days, this was actually a big step forward. It allowed you to make even better use of your resources. Okay. So as operating systems continue to evolve, okay, they became more complex and they added more functionality. So one more thing that, so there were these huge projects like Multics. Multics was this operating system that was developed by General Electric and MIT. That was essentially a failure in some sense, a programming failure, because they kept adding functionality and they just couldn't keep up, and it took 6 years for them to write this operating system, and it had lots of bugs. It didn't really do what it was supposed to do. Okay? But that said, some of the functionality that Multics included was multi-user programming. Okay? So multi-programming assumes that you can run multiple programs at the same time. If when you have multi-users, you can have multiple users interacting with the machine at the same time, and each user may be running multiple programs. Okay? So you just as if three users are logged into a machine, let's say three users SSH into the machine, there are three users accessing the machine at the same time. And then you SSH and you could run a variety of programs. Okay, so you have multiple users as well as each user running multiple programs all at the same time. Okay, so those were some additional functionality. Okay, now, there's another way to think about this. Okay, so now we can actually go in terms of time as opposed to just features. So if you actually peek back into the 70s, okay, this is when the first Unix operating system was designed. Okay, so this actually was designed 6 years and basically didn't work. Okay? Now the lessons of Multics are still not being learned today. Okay, if you look at large computer systems, some projects that actually are used deliver large computers, large software systems fail and others succeed. Why is that the case? Okay, so if you think about any large operating system design, this is important to realize. Okay, it is very important to plan large projects ahead of time. Just as it will be important for you to plan your 3-person programming project ahead of time. If each person assumes the other person is going to do something and you haven't really planned it, your group project is not going to be delivered on time. But if you actually plan ahead, you say these are the interfaces. You write this component, this is the interface that you will export to me. I will write my component, this is how my component will interact with you. you do all of this planning. So this is all software engineering stuff. Okay, software engineering was not something that was known in those days. But if you do all of your software engineering well, projects will succeed. If you don't, they will not. It is the same lesson that you actually learn from the failure of Multics and the success of Unix. Okay. Now, that said, Unix also introduced a number of other features. It had this notion of an interactive shell. Okay. This allowed users to quote unquote log into a machine and interact with it online rather than submitting their jobs as a bad job and getting a result 3 hours later. Okay. So you could actually compile your program, run it online and see what the program is doing, rather than just walking in with a tape and say run this, and you come back 3 hours later and says code dump, your program didn't work. Then you need to figure out why it didn't work. Okay. So interactive computing was made popular by Unix. Okay. This allowed users to interact with the machine online. Okay. The other thing that Unix did was everything was a file. Okay. The abstraction that Unix provided to users was that of a file. A file could contain program, but the file